Your Honors, Ahilan Arulanandam, and with me is Judy Rabinowitz for the petitioners, Mr. Soeth and Joof. Your Honors, we've allocated 20 minutes for those two cases. We'd like 5 minutes of rebuttal, so I guess that leaves me about 15 minutes.
How do you say it? Is it Joof?
It's Joof, like
J-U-F. It's D-I-O-U-F, right?
Yeah, but it's pronounced Joof, like J-U-F.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, the District Court's preliminary injunction order in these cases got it exactly right. It's a straightforward application of this Court's decisions in Tijani and Nataraja and holds that our clients should not be subjected to prolonged detention without a simple detention hearing.
How does the District Court's order comply with Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 52?
Your Honor, both sides have said in these cases that the order should be read to incorporate the arguments that are made in the briefing.
But that's not what National Popsicle Corp. versus Isoclair says, is it?
Your Honor, there's not a whole lot of explanation in the preliminary injunction order. And I think...
Is there any?
There's really only the form language in the beginning and the rest of the decision itself, Your Honor.
But doesn't the rule require such an explanation?
I think it can be read to require a greater explanation than is in the District Court's
Let me say it a different way. If this didn't involve an issue that you passionately believe in, would there be any question in your mind that this doesn't satisfy Rule 52?
Well, Your Honor, I do think that the parties have to assert it. And here the government explicitly states that they think that the order should be read to incorporate the reasons in the brief. You know, I don't think that other than the government's concession, I would be willing to defend.
So you're basically saying that this is a collective waiver of the issue?
Yes, Your Honor. And I don't think that it sort of goes to the subject matter jurisdiction of this Court reviewing the preliminary injunction. Beyond that, I'm not going to defend the detail level of the explanation in the preliminary injunction order, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The government asks this Court essentially to nullify the decisions in Tijani and Nataraja, and really to give it extraordinary power, the power to hold people for however long it takes for their cases to finish, even if that means for years of detention, without a simple detention hearing. You know, and I really think that's inconsistent with Nataraja and Tijani, because in Nataraja, this Court held that when Congress wants to authorize detention beyond 6 months, it does so explicitly. And it did do so explicitly, Your Honor, in the Patriot Act. It authorizes detention beyond 6 months, but limits that detention to national security cases. And even then, it provides greater procedural protections than our clients received here before we won in the district court. And Tijani, Your Honor, so Judge Fischer, when you said you're interested in knowing what statute governs, we don't think that what statute governs is particularly important to the resolution of these cases, because Nataraja holds that the statutes that don't explicitly authorize detention beyond 6 months should not be read to do so. And none of the statutes here do that.
So you're suggesting that there's an automatic cutoff at 6 months?
No, Your Honor. There's a hearing at 6 months. Now, whether or not you get out on the hearing is a different matter. But at detention of 6 months, there has to be a determination that the detention continues to be reasonable. And we think that's required by the cases.
This defendant had a hearing, though, right?
Yes. Both of the petitioners here had their hearings, and they won. The immigration judge found that they were not dangerous or flight risks. In fact, the immigration judge called the government's argument that Mr. Soeth a flight risk disingenuous, Your Honor.
So your argument, I gather, is that no hearing's even necessary. They should just be released.
Well, he has been.
Right. Well, now.
Stay out, basically.
Yeah. Yes, exactly, Your Honor. That's right. In Tijani, the court found that there was a serious constitutional problem with holding the alien there who had obtained a stay of removal in his immigration case for 28 months and construed Section 1226, therefore, to require a hearing where the government actually bears the burden of proof. Now, that, I think, answers the question that you asked, Judge Fischer, what statute governs these cases. All of the petitioners here have stays of removal. And Tijani held that where the petition had a stay of removal, Section 1226 is what they construed. Now, there's not a detailed explanation of that in Tijani, but I don't think it's possible to reconcile the government's statutory position with what the court did in Tijani.
Well, stay of removal, you say they have a stay of removal, but the stay of removal arises out of a habeas proceeding, right?
No, Your Honor. The stay of removal happens when you have a final BIA order.
Yeah.
Then when you file your petition for review,
right.
You then...
The Ninth Circuit
grants a stay. So it's not...
So in your... In
Mr. Juf and Soet.
They both have stays issued out of this court.
Yes, out of this court.
On direct appeal from the BIA.
Yes, on the petition for review is the technical term that, from the BIA.
I understand.
That's right. Sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
Now, you said all the petitioners have stays of removal. I wasn't aware that all of them issued out of this court.
I don't know the answer to Mr. Prieto.
You're talking about
this. Yes, Your Honor. I know that all four have stays of removal. How they got them, I'm not sure.
Right.
And, Your Honor, Tijani held that to remedy the constitutional problem, they should be given a bond hearing, and that's all that we seek. All that we seek is a bond hearing, and as you said,
but you got
Your Honor, we got that bond hearing, and they're out, and all we ask really is that in Mr. Juice's case that you affirm that, in Mr. Soet's case, because it was vacated as moot, we think you should reverse the decision vacating it as moot and order that the petition be granted because of what happened at the hearing. I think the facts in these cases, Your Honors, show why this hearing is so important. Mr. Juice is a university graduate. He's lived in this country more than 10 years. He's married to an American citizen. But if we had lost in the district court, he would have been held for almost 3 years as of today, even though he's never been convicted of a removable offense. And, you know, Mr. Stoa's case, I think, is even worse. He's a Christian minister from Indonesia. He's never even been arrested for a crime, let alone convicted. And he would have been detained for 3.5 years if we had lost at the district court as of today. And the government says that notwithstanding the...
Isn't your statement that he is now a Christian minister? You said he was a Christian minister in Indonesia, but he's become a Christian minister.
Yes, Your Honor. He was a Christian in Indonesia. He was not a Christian minister at that time.
Yes.
He has become one.
Yes. That's what I'm suggesting. I understood you to say he was a Christian minister in Indonesia.
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor.
Since become a minister.
Yes, Your Honor. He practiced there as well. It's part of the basis for his asylum claim, but he didn't become a minister until he was here.
Counsel, I'm interested in Tijani. It's a very interesting case. It asserts two things that seem to have come out of thin air, one of which is the burden of proof issue. What's your position with respect to both under 1226 and 1231 that there are CFR regulations that put the burden of proof on the petitioner in both cases? Do you believe that Tijani overruled those regulations by innuendo?
It did. It's certainly true that there could have been more explanation. In fact, Judge Tashima said, you know, we really need some clarity on this, and I think the absence of that clarity is reflected in
the... By the way, how should we read our friend Judge Tashima's concurring opinion? That's not the opinion of the court, right?
It's purely persuasive. It does not bind this panel.
The opinion is cryptic.
Yes,
and it says nothing about these things. But it is your position, I gather, that both 8 CFR 236.1C8 and 8 CFR 241BD1 are impliedly overruled by Tijani.
Well, let me say a little bit more about that, Your Honor. I think that the regulations have to be construed to not apply to prolonged detention where the person continues to litigate their case. You know, and that's what's their immigration case, and that's what's presented in these cases, Your Honor. Tijani, it's right. It's not a detailed explanation, but it's drawing on a wealth of case law that I think you see. There's a citation there to Cooper v. Oklahoma. Cooper v. Oklahoma says, it's a unanimous decision in the Supreme Court, says that whenever we have civil proceedings where the interests involved are more than mere money, the burden is clear and convincing evidence on the government. If you also look, Your Honor, Tijani cites Zedvitas. It doesn't say much more than that, but it does cite Zedvitas. And if you read the Supreme Court's constitutional discussion in Zedvitas, which is pages 690 to 92 of the opinion. There's a wealth of citations to other due process case law governing civil detention. And one of the things that those cases say, a whole load of them, Addington, Fuchsia, United States v. Salerno, those cases say.
Yeah, but your counsel, with respect, in the Supreme Court cases, you're really talking about the overriding constitutional issue, if you will. If it's improbable that you're going to be released within a certain period of time, then the petitioner has the burden under Zedvitas to show that that's the case. Then the government has to refute it. So the initial burden in that case and its progeny is on the petitioner. In Tijani, our case, despite the fact that it deals with an entirely different issue, which is what's the burden of proof in a bail bond hearing, that case says that the government bears the burden of proof, despite the fact that the regulations say that the petitioner has the burden. So what I'm looking for, what is the authority of our court in Tijani to overrule this obligation under the regulations?
Well, I think the court can construe the regulations that the government's relying on to not apply to prolonged detention, because none of them say anything about prolonged detention. And that would be similar to what the court is already doing to the statutes.
But it's a constitutional interpretation you're applying, right? It's not a statutory construction issue. You're basically saying the Constitution trumps these regulations.
Well, I think you can construe a regulation to avoid a constitutional problem the same way you can a statute. The authority I would cite for that is Kwong Hai Chu v. Colding, which we cite in the briefs in Mr. Stewart's case. So I think it's the same, and it's the same issue, same rationale. I think that's how you should construe it. I do think there's a constitutional problem with putting the burden on the petitioner where the detention is prolonged, not, you know.
When does it become prolonged? Six months?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think that the Constitution has the word 6 months in it, obviously, but it seems like it comes from a variety of different contexts, 6 months. 6 months, the Supreme Court says, constitutionally doubtful in Zedvitas. Nataraja notes that the Patriot Act also points to 6 months. Nataraja itself construes the statutes to do 6 months. DeMoor v. Kim, Nataraja reads DeMoor, and other courts do this too, as sort of implicitly holding that 6 months is probably a benchmark there, because they repeatedly call the detention brief when they uphold it, and they note that there it's usually 47 days, sometimes five months.
You know. But, and take all of that as a given. That has to do with the overriding issue of whether constitutionally you can hold somebody who has shown that it's improbable that they're going to be released within a period of time past the 6 months. But here we're talking about a bail hearing. What they were entitled to in those cases was a bail hearing in most instances. Not in Nataraja, of course, that's different. But
nor in Zedvitas, Your Honor.
True. But in Tijani, they were saying, you know, go check this out. Find out whether the guy's he's a danger to the community or he's going to flee. But the burden's on the government. And my question to you is, how does that burden get shifted there? On what authority did our court rely, impliedly or otherwise, to get there? Because Zedvitas doesn't deal with this issue. This
right.
is a separate issue.
Right. Yeah, I think any time you have prolonged detention, whether or not it's, you know, potentially permanent or whatever it may be, any time you have prolonged detention and it's not criminal, right, so it's not for a criminal sanction, the burden of proof has to be on the government. And that's, I think, the sum total of what that constitutional discussion in Zedvitas, although I understand what you're saying, that in some respects it's arguably different in Zedvitas, but the constitutional discussion there cites to cases from a whole variety of contexts. You know, Salerno's pretrial, some of them are about mental illness and about other things.
But isn't the issue due process? The court was assuring that that Tijani got due process.
Yes, Your Honor.
Not that Tijani would be released necessarily. Maybe so, maybe no.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. And I think there's a serious constitutional problem with a statute that's going to let you detain somebody for 6 months without giving them a hearing where the government bears the burden of proof. If the government wants to hold you outside a criminal process for more than 6 months, they're the ones who have to explain why. And I think that's to sort of that's the best we can do on Tijani, Your Honor. I think if you held that the burden of proof was on the petitioner, certainly you'd create conflict with Tijani, but I think you'd also create conflict with this other body of civil case law.
But at bottom, you're making a constitutional argument. You're saying that those two regulations are unconstitutional because there's prolonged detention, and in that situation, the burden has to be on the government.
Yeah, I do think that's true, but I think that even if the court was only convinced that there was a serious question, you don't have to accept 100% what I've said, but if you think it's a serious constitutional problem, then I think you can construe the regs to, as I've said, to put the burden on the government in prolonged detention cases. Your Honor, that's 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I hope we can have the rest of the time for rebuttal.
You can. Now, just as a matter of process, is this the way this is unfolding? The question I have is whether we should have the government respond on this case, or are you going to be picking up?
I think we originally anticipated the government would respond
at the end.
Well, I understand. The government's okay with that?
Yeah, we're acceptable, thank you.
All right, fine.
May it please the Court, I'm Matt Adams with Northwest Immigrant Rights Project on behalf of Mr. Prieto, and I'd seek to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal at the end. The vast majority of removal cases are completed within 6 months, but the fact that the overwhelming majority of these cases comply with this reasonable time period does not absolve the government of its responsibility to provide the requisite statutory and constitutional protections to those few individuals whose cases are not resolved in an expeditious manner. Mr. Prieto's case is one of these. In February, he will now have been detained for 3 years. The government has kept him locked up for the 3 years while he's challenged this removal process, notwithstanding the fact that he's been in this country for 30 years, every single day with lawful status and has never violated a law. The last 14 years, a social worker for the state of Oregon. The last 10 years, working a weekend job, a second job, doing outreach to the homeless. He has one misdemeanor conviction for which he was sentenced to 30 days. And that was almost 20 years ago. The government did not even argue that he was a danger to the community. In their custody review report, they conceded that point.
What statute do you believe authorized, you probably don't say he's authorized now, but what's he being held under? What statute?
Given that a petition for review was filed and a stay was entered by the court, our position was that 236 does not apply because there was no longer removal proceedings. He had a final administrative order. And yet 241 did not apply because that stay was entered pursuant to 241AB.
Do you think it's in limbo?
I think it's in limbo. There is not a clear statute that authorizes detention. I think if you have to construe a statute that authorizes detention, the more acceptable interpretation would be 236. And there's
got to be one or the other, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know whether there's a statute. I mean, if you look at this scheme that Congress set up where they said, we're detaining these folks because we assume all of them are going to be done in an expeditious manner, and the majority of folks are going to be removed. And even if they want to challenge or seek judicial review of that removal, they can leave the country because they still have jurisdiction. So Congress anticipated the majority of cases are going to be done. And I would assume that Congress had the same assumption that for those few individuals where the case was not completed within that time period and the stay was granted, then there would no longer be a need to detain them during that lengthy judicial
process. That's not. Let's just take 241. And 241, first of all, under 1226 or 236, essentially detention is authorized pending a decision on removal, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so then the petitioner gets a administrative order of removal from the BIA, okay? Or, and if it doesn't appeal, then under Section 241 says now he's into the removal period. correct?
Correct.
And it says that he shall be removed during within that 90 days, which is what Congress seems to have in mind. But it says the removal period begins on the latest of one of two dates that are relevant here anyway. The date of the order of removal becomes administratively final, that's BIA, or, as your client did, as I understand it, the removal order is judicially reviewed and the court orders a stay, which is this court. And that's the posture in which he comes.
Correct.
So is it your position that during the pendency of whatever this court is doing, he's no longer subject to detention?
There's no longer statutory authority authorizing that detention if a stay of removal has been granted, correct?
So at that point, they have to let him out under supervised release kind of conditions, presumably, or make a showing, in your view, that he's a flight risk.
Exactly. Or a special showing regarding danger to the community.
Well, your client's had two hearings before an administrative law judge, right? Denied bail in 2005, then was granted bail, I believe, in 2007. Is that right? No, he was granted bail of $15,000, but he couldn't meet the bail.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
And actually, during the administrative process, he had two bond hearings before the immigration judge, because the first one he appealed and the BIA sustained that appeal.
Okay, so he had due process. What authority do we as a court of appeal have to visit the issue of what the administrative law judge thinks is an appropriate amount of bail?
I would argue, first of all, that he hasn't had due process as required by this court to Johnny. Tijani said that the government must establish that he's a flight risk or a danger to the community.
Well, he must have met the burden one way or another, perhaps harmless error, because the administrative law judge granted him the right to be out on bail. So he met that burden somehow. He didn't think he was a flight risk, or he didn't think he was a danger to the community. He would never authorize bail in the first place. What he did was set bail at $15,000, which apparently, according to the record, he knew this defendant could not meet. What's wrong with that?
There's two points. One is, given that the record demonstrates that the immigration judge understood he couldn't pay a bail, by setting a bail, that was the equivalent of setting no bond. He knew that this individual would not be able to pay the $15,000. It was simply another mechanism to prevent his release and to prolong his detention. There's many mechanisms that the judge could have used. He could have said, all right, I still have concerns. I'm going to require his release pending electronic monitoring, or I'm going to require in-person reporting. There's a whole bag of tools that the government uses with certain cases when they issue release on conditions.
How much could your client afford to pay?
As we presented to the court, he didn't have any funds at that point, 3 years later.
So if the IJ had said, I'm going to require a $500 bond, in your mind, this would still be an abuse of discretion or certainly a miscarriage of justice by your perspective?
In this case, we argued that if the judge said what the judge believed was the minimum bond, even though our client couldn't get that, at least we'd have a chance of getting a charity organization to try to raise those funds. Sometimes that happens on a practical matter. But where the judge set it at 10 times the amount of what the judge believed was the minimum, then clearly the purpose was to prevent his release.
Okay, again, what is our authority as a court of appeal to second-guess the IJ in this case? What's the basis of it?
What must be first and foremost here is this is a habeas petition. This is not someone who's seeking judicial review of one of those initial two administrative bond hearings. So the authority of this court is its standard authority in reviewing any denial of a habeas petition. The district court denied his habeas petition after the immigration judge issued this bond. But the immigration judge's bond hearing was part of the habeas petition. That was the district court delegating its authority. The district court could have just as easily held that hearing as it had ordered the immigration judge to hold that hearing.
And what did the IJ do wrong in this case?
The immigration judge did three things wrong. First of all, he placed the burden on Mr. Prieto. to demonstrate that he's not a flight risk. And second of all, instead of looking at the individual facts, he made a legal error that contradicts the holding of this court to Johnny, saying that a person who has a final order and is seeking judicial review is automatically a flight risk, instead of doing an individual analysis of the facts. And third, the immigration judge then set a bond, which was the equivalent of setting no bond, which required Mr. Prieto's ongoing detention, since he had no practical means of paying that bond. And the immigration...
What should he have done, in your view?
In my view, he should have either ordered him released on whatever conditions that that were available, like electronic monitoring or requiring in person, or he should have set a bond that at least counsel had represented we would have an opportunity for a charitable organization to raise. In this case, the government, it should be noted that at that custody hearing, the government did not even present any evidence that he was a flight risk. And like I said, the government had already conceded he was not a danger to the community. And I see that my time is coming up, so I'd seek to preserve one more minute for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the Court, James Fife of Federal Defenders, on behalf of Mr. Casas. Your Honors, the question here is really straightforward. The government's not arguing that Tijani and Nadarajah were wrongly decided. It's simply that they don't apply to these cases. But Mr. Casas squarely falls within the parameters of these cases as showing that he has been unreasonably detained for 6 years, twice as long as the nominal sentence imposed in his criminal case, three times as long as the actual time he served on those cases, twice the time that was found excessive in Tijani, and 2 years longer than the term of detention in Nadarajah, which this Court said was plainly unreasonable by any measure. Moreover, he raises three substantive arguments in his challenge to his deportation. One of them, which the government has conceded, is meritorious. Another, the government has admitted it does not have the documentary proof to sustain its burden. And in a third one, which it doesn't respond to at all. So Mr. Casas has shown he raises colorable claims to his deportation, but he has been detained for 6 years without any chance for release.
What exactly does your client want?
Mr. Casas wishes to be released, which is the relief which numerous of these cases, precedents in this case have given.
He wants to be released as in without any kind of a hearing. He just wants to be released because of the time that he's spent in custody.
That's right. Well, that's correct, Your Honor. Not completely just cut loose and throw down on the street. He acknowledges that he should be subject, as Savita says, to the usual and appropriate conditions of supervision as any of the other 16,000 deportees which ICE supervises. Now, there's a number of remedies that have been made available in the case law, and that makes sense because these are all review of habeas cases, and habeas cases can craft the appropriate relief. It's not simply release and that's the only thing. There can be conditions applied. But release has been seen as the underlying relief which is granted on habeas petitions. Advaitis points that out with conditions. Judge Tashima and Tijani said that he, in his view, the relief should have been release forthwith. Nadarajah gave release three times over. It gave release based on the habeas. It gave a release based on ordering that he be admitted to parole. And it also gave him release based on his motion under Rule 23B for bail. He was released three times over. Couldn't emphasize stronger that the relief is release. Moreover, as Judge Smith is pointing out, that there is a condition where the length of detention means that there is no point in going to any further procedure. A sliding scale is...
Are you ready to tell us what the bottom line should be in our ruling, in your view?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that Mr. Casas has been detained for such a long time, and there is such a minimal showing of any flight risk or danger that he should be released under the normal conditions of supervision that appropriately apply to any detainee that ICE is supervising. And just to give you an idea of that, because if the court will indulge me, just
on
to...
What authority would we do it?
Under the authority of habeas relief. The basic relief under a habeas case is to grant release. But, as Advaitis points out, this could be release under reasonable conditions. And the reasonable conditions would be the usual and appropriate ones, which apply in numerous thousands of detention cases. I've been doing these indefinite detention cases for 2 years. It's half of my caseload. I've had scores of these clients who've been released. In fiscal year 2007, our office had a 90% release rate of our clients. Less than 10% of our clients were either removed or their cases were terminated some other way. 90% of our clients get released from ICE under reasonable conditions. And Mr. Casas is one of them who has been denied release repeatedly. And yet when you look at his case compared to some of my other clients, the regulations have a special concern for violence. There's within two subsections of 241.4 EF, the regulations refer to a history of violence three times. Mr. Casas has no violent convictions at all. In fact, as the district court said, not now, not ever. He's never been violent. And yet I have had clients released with such violent convictions as aggravated assault, assault with a deadly weapon, solicitation of murder. And just to give the court a concrete measure, I brought with me today, and I have my client's permission to do this, a client recently was released. This is his order of supervision, similar to parole conditions in a criminal case, just boxes which ICE checks what his conditions are. He was released on November 9th of last year. And it's got the usual conditions, the standard conditions, report in, not to travel outside California, attend a medical exam if ordered, etc. There's one special condition, comply with all parole requirements. That's because Mr. Gill was convicted of attempted murder. He was in custody, ICE custody, for 4 months, and then was released on an order of supervision. Mr. Casas has an expunged misdemeanor from 14 years ago. A felony auto burglary from 8 years ago. That's his total criminal record. The district court found that he has never been a threat to violence, and yet he's being held for 6 years with no chance of release.
Now, let me ask you this question. Your client has a very compelling factual situation, but we may as well use your case as the basis for discussing something that overlies a number of these issues. It's the government's contention that when a petitioner files, appeals, seeks relief, gets stays, and so on, that in fact that is an act that basically makes it so they can't leave the country, and therefore that ought to be told, if you will, in terms of the time that someone is held. What is your position on that?
Your Honor, I think that I cite some of the cases in my briefs that point out that simply pursuing your legal remedy shouldn't be seen as an act of obstruction. In fact, Judge Hatter in the Martinez versus Gonzalez case, which I cited to the court, found that precisely. I mean, when we're talking about the Pelich situation, where Pelich is someone who has lied to immigration about his origins, these are people who deliberately obstructed. That there's nothing like that in this case.
So from your position, the fact that the government cannot remove someone because a stay is in place. You don't buy the argument that they hold the key to their own release by being removed.
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. One, as Judge Hatter pointed out in Martinez, the fact that this court is not obligated to grant a stay. And, in fact, I have a client where this court has denied a stay because, they basically find that there's not enough substance to it to grant a stay. The court can deny that and does deny them. So the fact that, and as Judge Hatter observed, that, well, if the court does grant a stay, that at least means that it's not frivolous and dilatory, as this court would have found otherwise. But I think that the real answer is exactly what Judge Tashima pointed out into Johnny, is that there is a standard. It's not simply if you file an appeal, you get an automatic stay and you get to release. You have to show that you have a substantive argument. And I think that's a reasonable requirement to be made in the district court, to show that you have a substantive argument and that your delay has been unreasonably prolonged.
Well, let's just say, for example, that the validity of the appeal is in the eye of the judge, I suppose, at some point. But let's just say that somebody is effectively represented, like in your client's case. You're a fine lawyer, and you know when to file these things, and by golly, there's never a chance this person's going to leave the country because you've always got something up before some court. You're always seeking a stay, and during the entire period that your client is in custody, there's a stay, and the government can never possibly remove the person. What's your take on that? Is that a is it reasonable to say the government is acting improperly keeping somebody there, or nonetheless they should have a hearing, be entitled to a bail hearing, be able to get, in your case, a supervised release, regardless of what's going on in terms of the appeal, unless the government, say, acts in bad faith and does something like that?
I think, Your Honor, that what I would argue for is exactly what happened in Mr. Costa's case, or what should have happened, is that if he has a stay and it's been prolonged, the detention has been prolonged because it looks like it's going to take quite some time to decide the issues, that he can go into federal court and say, look, my detention has been prolonged, but I'm raising substantive issues, which a district judge can, in his sound discretion, determine, yes, these are reasonable issues. I think, as Judge Tashima said, they deserve a closer look. I don't think
so. The issue is not whether there's a stay, but rather whether the appeal is meritorious.
Correct,
or potentially meritorious.
In fact, I intend to argue that exactly in my case, where the court has denied my client's stay. That it doesn't matter that there's not a stay, because, in fact, even though there's not a stay, the government has not been able to remove him. They aren't able to get travel documents. So he's nonetheless stuck in custody, even though there's not any official legal reason why he could not be removed. He should not remain in custody otherwise, if he shows that he has a substantive argument. In this case, the client has a CAT claim, and that would be a very substantial argument if he's able to sustain that. So I don't think that the stay is, a stay is one good reason. I mean, because that's at least a judicial determination that this argument is not frivolous and dilatory. There's been some gatekeeping already, so that when the client comes into the district court and says, here are my reasons why I think I raise colorable claims that are sufficient, that I should be released under appropriate conditions, then there's no reason, any more than we withhold bail in such cases, in criminal cases.
Okay, that the person have your point.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Tom Dupree on behalf of the United States. I'll be presenting the government's argument in the first case, the Dioff case, and my colleague, John Jinchai, will be presenting the government's argument in the second case, in the third case, and then I'll present it again in the final case. And with the Court's indulgence, I would also like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if permissible.
All right. Is your appellant in a couple of them?
I appreciate that, Judge Fischer. Let me get right to the issue of indefinite detention, because I think that is a theme that encompasses all four cases presented for decision today, and the petitioners certainly spoke at length about it in their presentations. Simply put, this is not a case of indefinite detention.
Can I let me ask you to indulge me first, and just go to Section 241, and if we can I can understand the government's position on what these sections, how they play out. As I went through with one of counsel for petitioners, as I understand it, the government, once it commences a removal action, has authority to detain for some period of time. That's the fundamental, as I understand it.
That's right.
Okay. So the way, at least, it unfolds in Section 241 is that until there's a final order of removal, whatever authority the government has may be subject to limitations that have been argued for here, but at least Congress has gone through the statute and provided that once the removal period begins, there are certain statutory consequences and authorities that flow from that.
Okay. I think that's right, but if I may qualify it, Your Honor said at the end, when the removal period begins, and I think that really may get to the essence of the disagreement of the two sides here.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get to.
Right.
Okay, I'm just taking the language of the statute, okay? So the language of the statute says, detention, release, and removal of aliens ordered removed. Okay. So up until that point, they're being held under the authority of what, Section 242?
It's 236, and then it becomes 241.
236, okay, right. All these numbers are, some are using 1223. You know, trying to keep them, sorry. All right, so there's an authority pending the decision to remove, an authority to detain.
That's exactly right.
Okay, now we're moving into the removal period. Now they've gone through the process of getting, they've gone through the IJ process, they've gotten to the BIA. Okay, now Congress has provided, if the BIA enters a order of removal and it's not appealed, then this removal period starts, correct?
That's right.
All right, and if the alien does appeal to this court or a circuit court, and a stay is granted, then there are provisions that deal with that. The removal period has to wait how we dispose of it, correct?
That's right. The removal period would be tolled during the pendency of a stay issued by this court.
It's not tolled. It doesn't begin.
Well,
statutory language says that removal period begins on the latest of the following. Whether you call it tolling or whatever, I'm just sticking with what Congress told us. Okay, so it begins either on the date the order of removal, that's the BIA order, becomes administratively final, or if it's reviewed by us and we grant a stay, then they wait and the removal period will begin once we issue our mandate.
Well, if I could take issue with one small portion of what Your Honor said, and I think the Dioff case actually provides an excellent example of this. In Mr. Dioff's case, the Court will recall, he was found removable or granted voluntary departure back in 2003. And his removal order became administratively final when he failed to show for voluntary departure. So at that point, the removal period began, and so although he certainly received a stay from this court, I don't think it would be correct to say that the removal period in Mr. Dioff's case began in 2005 or has never begun because the stay is still in place. The removal period began, it was running, and then it was tolled upon issuance of a stay by this court. So I think that also gets to Judge Smith's colloquy earlier about whether there's a lacuna between 236 and 241. The government's interpretation resolves that problem, because under our view, the clock starts ticking as soon as you have a final administrative order of removal in place. It may be tolled during the pendency of a stay issued by this court, and then upon the dissipation of a stay, it begins anew. That's the one way that you can reconcile.
Let's say hypothetically that the stay goes into effect 1 second after the administratively final order is entered. Would it ever begin until that stay was, would the removal period begin until that stay was lifted?
I think it would, if I understand Your Honor's question correctly, as long as there is some time in which you've got an administratively final order of removal,
right,
and there's some time elapses before the stay is entered, yes, the removal period would begin during that time.
That's a strange reading of the statute.
But I think, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think our reading not only is consistent with the statutory text, but I think it avoids the, if I may say, absurd results that the petitioners are urging this court to adopt.
Okay, so what you're doing is you're saying it begins and then it unbegins.
Tolls.
Or is tolls. Not being the language of the statute, but taking that concept. So in any event, we've now shifted into a Section 241 regime. Once there is a BIA order, final order, even if there's a second in between that and the stay of the, the removal period has begun.
That's exactly right.
Okay, so now at least we have a statutory structure on detention authority and rights and remedies that governs. No lacuna. We're all.
I solved your problems, Your Honor.
Okay, so let's say we go with that. All right, then that says that the government has 90 days, it's used up, let's say it's used up 5 days before the Ninth Circuit butts in with a stay. All right? Okay, so now it's tolled. So you've got 85 days in which to act. And then the clock will start ticking when our mandate issues.
When the stay is lifted, yes.
Okay, when it's final. All right. So then the detention authority is circumscribed by the very terms of the statute. It says, as I understand it, you've got the government has two ways to extend detention. One, it can extend the 90-day period through subsection C, or it can prolong it, extend it under subsection 6, which is the flight risk concept, correct?
That's right.
Otherwise, the presumption is, or the statutory structure contemplates, the person will be put on supervised release.
I think that's right. I think that's
okay,
right so far.
So we're all agreed there. So in order to respond to the concerns of petitioners who have presumably all come in under Section 241, in your view, to assess whether they are being properly detained beyond 90 days, we should be looking as to whether the government has complied with either suspension, Congress called it suspension period, but the failure to cooperate Section C, or is a flight risk under subsection 6. I'm skipping a whole lot of intervening numerals.
I would characterize A1C not as the failure to cooperate section, but as the act to prevent removal section.
Okay.
Because I think that's exactly what's going on in this case.
So on that point, you think that if an alien seeks judicial review in a non-frivolous manner of his underlying detention, that's somehow tolls the 90-day period? Or?
Absolutely, and that's the plain language of A1C. A1C says if the alien acts to prevent removal. I can't imagine Congress speaking more clearly on that exact point.
So you think judicially appealing, seeking judicial review, is what Congress had in mind?
Absolutely.
Okay, and what's the authority for that other than just that? You think that's...
The plain text of the statute, for one thing...
Conspires or acts to prevent the...
Acts to prevent removal. I would think filing a motion to stay removal is an act to prevent removal. I don't think the English language can be contorted, as the petitioners would suggest, to say that when I file a motion with the circuit court saying, please stay my removal, I haven't acted to stay my removal. I think this is a plain language analysis on that point. I would point out that the 11th Circuit has agreed with that. The 11th Circuit... In the Achenwald case, agrees 100% with that analysis. They say when an alien files a motion for stay of removal, absolutely that's acting to stay removal, to prevent removal. So I think that is a result that is compelled by the plain text of the statute, and again, it's consistent with the way at least one other circuit court has approached the issue. Let me say a few words, if I could, about the indefinite detention point. In Zavitas, the Supreme Court characterized an indefinite detention as one in which removal is not practically attainable or one where detention is potentially permanent. And I think that in the circumstances that obtain here, where these aliens have all obtained stays of removal pending a decision by this court, it is clearly not the case that removal is not practically attainable or that their detention is potentially permanent. I think Zavitas is addressing an entirely different situation where you did have people who, at least in theory, could be detained permanently, whereas in this case, these aliens are simply awaiting a decision from this court. The Tenth
You're saying that Zavitas does not apply in a 241 situation?
Well, I would say it applies in a 241 situation if you have a Zavitas-type situation, namely one in which we are prevented from removing someone because we can't find a country of origin to which to remove the person, or there's a problem obtaining travel documents. But in a 241...
That's not exactly what the court said, is it? It just spoke in terms of a practical result, whether there was an indefinite time period that was was unrealistic it was going to be resolved in any short time period.
But the language that the court used to characterize that situation is one in which it said removal is potentially permanent and not practically attainable. In this case, certainly in the case of Mr. Dioff, we are ready, willing, and able to remove Mr. Dioff to Senegal as soon as this court lifts the stay. So I think to suggest that removal is not practically attainable, I think simply doesn't comport with the facts of his case, nor with the facts of the cases of the other petitioners. I would point out that in the Bekir case, which granted was an unpublished decision of this court agreed with our point that in a case where you have a pending appeal, detention is not potentially permanent.
Let me tell you, if they chose not to publish it, even if it's our court, that doesn't carry a whole lot of weight. If they thought it was...
It may even carry a negative weight.
Yeah. Otherwise, we wouldn't be spending our time today. So
let me address...
I want to move to another authority.
Well, the other authority I have on that point is the Soberanis case, which is the Tenth Circuit. The Tenth Circuit in Soberanis specifically held that when you have a pending court decision, the detention is not open-ended, the detention is not indefinite. The court said, for now, the petitioner's detention is clearly neither indefinite nor potentially permanent like the detention held improper in Zavigas. It is rather directly associated with a judicial review process that has a definite and evidently impending termination point. So I think the Tenth Circuit's approach there, too, dovetails with this court's unpublished approach in Bekir. Before...
Mr. Dupree, I think the basic disagreement between you and the other side, they assume that unless the detainee is either a flight risk or a danger to the community, he should not be in detention. He should be released, regardless of which statute, regardless of the particulars, he should be outside. I think your position, as I understand it, is he could be outside, he could be at home, he could be gone to his home country if he hadn't decided to bring certain actions that, in your view, interferes with his proceeding. And how do we resolve it? How do we resolve it, and on what theory? When we must now write, and we must say that either the question of whether he is a flight risk or unsafe or a danger to the community is not pivotal. What is pivotal is that he could be on his way back to his home country, but for actions that he's taking, in your view, to delay his removal. They are suggesting that he's not taking those actions, as I understand their position. They're just saying he can take these actions outside. He doesn't have to be detained while he takes them. So what do you say?
Well, it's a good question, Judge Carson. I have 2 points in response. The first is that I think it's important to note that DHS does provide post-custody or post-order custody determinations where they assess things such as dangerousness to the community or flight risk. So I think that a decision of this court holding that these petitioners are detained under 241 would not prevent them from having individualized assessments as to dangerousness, as to flight risk. They got those assessments.
How did they get that? In other words, what does that consist of? Do they get a personal interview? Do they go through
They absolutely can, Judge Fisher.
And is granted as a matter of course?
They do not have a right to an interview as a matter of right.
It's just a matter of the DHS looking at the file and on the paper, deciding whether or not in the district director's view it's a flight risk?
The initial review is a file review in which it is done on paper, and the DHS official reviews any submissions that the petitioner wishes to furnish for DHS's consideration. They have a right to a lawyer or a representative to participate in the process. They're given advance notice of when this review will occur so they can marshal their evidence. Then they get the individualized assessment that may include an interview. May include an interview, absolutely. Then subsequent to that...
discretion of...
It is, with one caveat, and this goes into the DHS regulations. Subsequent to the initial determination, there are provisions whereby once an individual has been detained for, I believe it's 1 year or so, there are provisions where they go to a two-panel review board that makes the determination, and if there's disagreement, there's a right to a hearing. So I don't want to say without qualification, they never have a right to a hearing.
What's the earliest point at which a detained petitioner who is pursuing a non-frivolous judicial review of the BIA order gets to have a personal confrontation with the decision maker as to whether or not he constitutes a flight risk that would justify keeping him in custody as opposed to being in his community?
I think it would be after the initial removal period had run. So I think it would be after several months. But I do think it's
are we talking 3 months, a year, what?
The difficulty is that I think DHS has the discretion to conduct certain hearings at various points in the process.
Right, so it's at the discretion of the DHS.
It is, but with an outside
link. It's not a Tijani hearing.
So it's not a Tijani hearing.
Right.
That's right.
So the next part of it then is who has the burden at that point to show whether or not he's a flight risk?
Well, as Judge Smith correctly noted, the burden rests with the alien.
Okay.
That is provided for under the regulations squarely.
So if we follow the regulations in your regime, he has a there's some discretion on the prosecuting agency to grant a personal interview and to make a decision in which the petitioner has the burden to establish that he's not a flight risk.
That's right.
Okay. And we should, in assessing that, should we be worried about constitutional implications for that?
Well, I don't think this Court need worry about that, because I think that while the Supreme Court has emphasized, in certain contexts at least, the importance of an individualized assessment, that doesn't necessarily translate into an actual full-blown hearing. I think one point that united all members of the Supreme Court in its detention decisions, such as Kim and Zavidas, was to the extent there may be some sort of due process interest, that rests in having an individualized determination.
By
and
whom?
And it can be by an administrative official. And it's that right to an individualized assessment that is fully vindicated by the DHS regulations. This is not a situation in which DHS is saying an entire category of individuals is taken off the table. They're giving individualized assessments. In Mr. Dioff's case, he presented evidence. There was a reasoned decision. So I think to the extent that the Court is concerned about any
happens if the DHS official makes what is a blatantly wrong decision?
There's no judicial review.
That's it.
There's no judicial review.
And you don't think that raises a constitutional issue?
Well, I mean, to be sure, there may be judicial review available in habeas if there are constitutional claims. Obviously, I know that this Court and the Real ID Act preserves jurisdiction over those types of claims. But I think in the typical case, if an alien's complaint is simply that DHS misadjudicated his level of dangerousness or his flight risk, I don't think that is something that is properly cognizable by this Court. And I don't think the Constitution...
Even on habeas?
Well, if they're not... The INA specifically provides that the Attorney General and DHS's determinations as to bail, release, those are not judicially reviewable. So, again, absent some narrow type of claim, I simply don't think there would be jurisdiction in this Court. And I don't think that's a remarkable result, and I don't think due process requires any more.
I want to ask one more thing before you sit down. In Tijani, the Court ordered an IJ to conduct a bail hearing when you were in the post-removal period under 1231. Does the government have a position as to whether there was any statutory basis for that order? We know about in 236 is a different matter. It's all set up there, but I can't find any statutory or administrative basis for an IJ hearing as opposed to a district court hearing or a bail hearing when you're in 1231. Do you know of any such authority?
There's absolutely no authority for that.
So it's just out of whole cloth.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Whole cloth sometimes, you know, in the Constitution.
Good morning. John Yunchai on behalf of the United States Attorney General, both as appellant and appellee in the cases of Mr. Suth and Mr. Prieto-Romero. Certainly the cases that I'll be discussing today obviously bring up the same issues, and to the extent that perhaps I may add further clarification with regard to what the court's main concerns are, that is, we believe that it should be what the statutory structure requires of detentions of individuals that have stays of removal. I want to start out by saying that the government's interpretation, I think, is sound. In one statute that hasn't been given any treatment really by any court is the one that we cite to 1252b8 that talks about the fact that the Attorney General has the authority, keeps the authority to detain an individual under Section 241 after final order of removal. And that provision is really the only bridge in 1252b8 that serves as a bridge between the judicial review provisions within specifically the subsection that provides that this court retains its authority to stay an alien's removal pending the adjudication of their petition for review. That subsection is the bridge, 1252b8 is the bridge between their judicial review and 241 detention. So that is the only statute that connects those two explicitly. So I would, of course, as the court has already taken note of that. So that takes us into the realm of, in the government's interpretation of, because we believe Congress has mandated that when there's a stay of removal, and even though there's a stay of removal, the Attorney General can detain an individual under 241, where are they detained under? The government's interpretation, as Mr. Dupree just described to the court, is that that individual is detained under 241A1C. The reason for that is because the stay is an act, but more importantly, because that section provides that the Attorney General may detain an alien under 241A1C, rather than requiring mandatory detention that the removal period requires. So because that provides for discretion, that's why the government has stated in its briefs these individuals do get those post-order custody reviews. It's not a situation where, quoting from Zavidas, where we're concerned with somebody being condemned to an indefinite term of imprisonment within the United States. That's not the case here. The government's interpretation provides for individualized reviews, albeit under Section 241. Now, moving to the case of Mr. Suth, I think it's important to note here it's the same situation. There is a stay of removal in place. Mr. Suth was not detained until after he filed an asylum application with the agency administratively. And then only after the immigration judge denied that asylum application, after the board reviewed and denied the application itself, after this court then reviewed and affirmed the agency's decision, essentially, after a petition for cert was taken to the Supreme Court denied it, it was only after that period in time that Mr. Suth was detained. So it was after there was a final order of removal as judicially reviewed from the administrative level all the way up to the Supreme Court, essentially. At that point is when Mr. Suth was taken into custody, and at that point is when Mr. Suth filed a second motion to reopen, which fairly recently, I believe it was October, the end of October, this court affirmed the, actually denied in part, dismissed in part, the denial of that motion to reopen in the asylum context. So I won't go into the details of which statute controls, but once again, that would be 241A1C in that situation. Now, the other case that I would like to talk about.
What kind of review did he get?
He got a post-order custody review.
Yeah, but what did that consist of in his case?
It was, as Mr. Dupree was discussing, it was a file review under Section ACFR 241.4. That's what he received under the post-order custody review context. Of course, Judge Hatter ordered that by way of his.
Later on, he got, through Judge Hatter, but through the administrative side of it, under the regulations, he got an initial file review, and that was it.
No, Judge. He received a file review in January. He was detained in September of 2004. He received a review in January 24th of 05, as well as April 27th of 05, and as the regulations provide, April 27th of 06.
So he got the annualized updates?
Ultimately, yes.
And did he ever have a personal interview?
No, he did not, Your Honor.
Okay, and what was the reason for that? We were just told that at least within a few months he'd get a personal interview.
Well, as I understand it, Your Honor, that is a discretionary. I think Mr. Dupree did say that it's a discretionary decision that he gets the personalized interview on
Friday. So in this case, we can use it for the proposition that that may mean he doesn't get one over several years.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And in terms of, and I assume that the burden was placed on him to establish he wasn't a flight risk.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. And I think what's important and significant in these cases, to bring up Tijani, at the outset, Tijani distinguished its holding from DeMoor versus Kim by saying this is a different situation. We're talking about someone here that did not concede their removability from the United States. In other words, did not concede whether they have the right to even be in the country to begin with. That's how this court distinguished DeMoor versus Kim. The situations here are individuals who, as been adjudicated by the agency and up through this court, the conclusion has come that they do not have the right to be in the United States. Certainly there are challenges still pending as to whether or not they have relief from removal, but that's different than what Tijani was considering and distinguished itself in the majority opinion from DeMoor versus Kim. The bare question of whether or not they have the right to be here. So I think that's an important factor to consider when we look at the type of proceedings as well that we're getting into. The post-order custody reviews are set up as delegates of the Attorney General and Department of Homeland Security to handle the individualized determinations of individuals who have been ordered removed, as opposed to IJ bond hearings of individuals where we haven't reached that determination yet.
You know, I don't want to interrupt your presentation, but before you sit down, I wish you'd tell us what, in your view, should be the bottom line of any decision that we make on these cases and the reason for it.
Well, Your Honor, this is a great time to do that, I think. I think that the
You're not going to cite any unpublished opinions, are you?
No, Your Honor. No, I'll do that right now because I see your time is going down. But without citing any unpublished decisions, I think that there are two important distinctions to be made. First of which is, these cases do not involve indefinite detention as discussed in Zavidas and contemplated in Zavidas. To be clear, Zavidas talked about prolonged and indefinite detention. I noticed that today during argument, they dropped the indefinite part from their position and just said prolonged detention. I think that's very significant. These are not cases that involve someone being condemned to prison. So that brings us to what is it that the government would like to
say. Wait a minute. They are in prison.
Well, they're detained.
They can't leave. They're confined. They're in a jail.
But I think the terms that Zavidas was discussing was the indefinite duration of that detention.
Right, where but you just said they weren't in prison. And I'm just wondering how you get to that. They are in prison.
They are detained at this point, but to the extent that I said that they are not detained, I misspoke. They're certainly detained.
They were condemned to prison.
Correct.
They're just in prison.
They're detained. Right. Condemned, I think, is taking the key and sort of tossing it out, which is what Zavidas was concerned with.
You're not suggesting they want to be there.
Well, Your Honor, I certainly nobody would like to remain detained, but I think it's important to note that in certain situations there is a choice. You know, the Lee versus Hansen case is discussed as authority to the prospect that even before final order removal, you look at the reasonless situation and the assessment is considered as to whether or not the person is ultimately going to be removed. In Lee versus Hansen, that individual could not be removed to Vietnam. The court distinguished that individual does not have the alternative of taking himself out of prison or detention and going back to Vietnam and litigating his petition for review. That individual was stuck unless the government released him. In these situations, for example, Mr. Prieto Romero, he certainly could litigate his petition for review. Congress has made clear in the statute that individuals may do that from abroad. Mr. Prieto Romero could certainly go to Mexico and litigate his case from Mexico. If he prevails, he would come back into it.
Realistically, counsel, I mean, it's hard enough for aliens to get representation as it is. Isn't it almost a fantasy land to think that somebody is going to go back to Ghana or Mexico or wherever else and be able to continue to litigate their case when they're not here anymore.
Your Honor, Congress certainly must have considered that when they provided that could be the case. And these, of course, this is litigation.
Is that Congress specifically considered that issue?
Well, there's nothing in the, that I can point to, but other than to say that these Congress was speaking to their right to the appellate side, a petition for review before a circuit court, that they can be removed and then litigate from abroad the appellate aspects.
Right, but I realize that Zabidas and the bail hearings and so on are at really two different levels. But ultimately, what's driving these folks who are representing the aliens is that the two Supreme Court cases that immediately dealt with this talked about situations of, you know, they thought they'd be done in 4 months or whatever. So they thought, well, presumptively 6 months is okay. I have a little chart I've created here for the five parties we're talking about today. And since the order, the final order of removal became effective, we've got in Fofana 2 years, Diouf, or Diouf, I guess he said, 20 months, and probably going from there, Prieto Romero, 2 years and 2 months, Suth, 2 years, 2.5 years, and then Casas Castrillon, 5.5 years. I mean, these are very extensive periods of time, well past the Zabidas framework. Now, I realize that the court was there talking in a slightly different context, but surely the government can see why this is a troubling issue from a civil liberties perspective. That's what we're having to wrestle with here. You know, nobody wants us to get into constitutional areas, but in effect, that's what the Supreme Court said is, we want to avoid the constitutional issue, but in order to do that, we have to construe the statute in such a way as to avoid these extensive, indefinite periods. Arguably, if you take the government's point, that if somebody had some really, really good litigators and they could just keep going and going, they could be in jail for 20 years while they're litigating their position. Isn't that right?
That's correct, Your Honor, but I don't think that precludes this court from concluding that, given those concerns, that the requirement must be that these individuals get individualized custody determinations while they're litigating their case. The fact is we have four individuals here in court, cases in court, but there are definitely, obviously, as there are individuals who have been released after custody reviews, mm-hmm. of course. So I think that gets into the...
Yeah, we've heard an argument today that, it's outside the record, but we'll, you know, nature of these cases, you sort of wander there anyway. He says, wait a minute, I got lots of clients who have worse records than my client in this case, and he's not getting released on his own, you know, under supervised release term, and yet the government's ICE is letting them out, DHS is letting them out, somebody who's got basically a worse record.
Well, Judge, I think that just goes to show that the system works and isn't set up in a manner to preclude individuals from being released.
Well, you think it works, and he thinks it's discriminatory.
And that's
just irrational.
And that's why
and your colleague says, and we have to take your word for it because we don't have any authority to review it, to find out whether, in fact, there is merit to
Well, Judge, certainly.
He's right.
My colleague is correct to state that there is no authority to review the discretionary determinations, but through the habeas corpus statute.
Well, there is as long as there's not a due process element. We have that jurisprudence, too. We can, to the extent that you kind of are trying to say don't go there because it's all hunky-dory, but in fact, we do have the authority to review constitutional claims. And if you want to push us into a constitutional determination, then that's where we have to go to find out whether or not this regime that you want us to construe as allowing the government at its discretion, unreviewable by any court, to keep somebody in custody while he's pursuing a good faith, meritorious claim that the BIA and the IJ made a mistake in ordering him removable. Your answer to that, as I understand it, is no, Congress made that decision. It said if you conspire or act, we should read that as saying that encompasses normal judicial review that they're entitled to, and that gives you authority to extend the removal period as long as the government gives him some modicum of review, unreviewable by any court, and that if he wants to not cool his heels in a detention center, which is costing the government a lot of time and money to maintain, he can go ahead, drop his claim. I think maybe Fofana may have done that. I don't know in that case. And go ahead and litigate from afar. That's the government's position.
Again, Judge.
Not quite stated so rhetorically antagonistically.
Correct. I think
the difficulty, I was hoping you were going to get back and give me your answer in a nutshell. Can you do it?
Yes. Let me give it to you in a nutshell. The statutory structure is set up in order to avoid any constitutional concerns. The government is of the position that individuals who are detained should get individualized custody determinations when they have a stay of removal pending a petition for review in a circuit court. The government's position is that Section 241 of the Act provides for that because the stay of removal is an act that prevents removal, therefore triggering 241A1C, which says the Attorney General has the discretion to detain those individuals. Therefore, the 241.4 regulations come into play where you have the individualized determinations at the earliest at the three-month mark, 90 days after their order of removal is final. It's been determined that they are removable at the administrative level at least. And that those custody review provisions are sufficient. And because certain individuals may remain detained thereafter, shouldn't lead this court to the conclusion that the government does not release individuals or that an individual does not have the right to seek review under the habeas corpus, not as to the discretionary determination, but certainly if the review is conducted in a manner that would, you know, reach constitutional problems, given the government's interest in having someone detained so that they're available for removal at the time of removal, and whatever liberty interest that removable individual has at that time, if those constitutional issues surface in an individualized case, not as a systematic approach, then the court can address that. The district court
addresses that through habeas.
Through habeas.
As was the case in Diouf and Sooth.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so that's the safety valve for constitutional abuse of discretion.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay.
But,
and the other side, as I understand it, would say there can be some restrictions on their liberty. They just can't be detained.
Well, Your Honor, I with the other side, that discounts the government's interest in keeping someone detained so that they're available for removal. And it's not a bright-line rule that if there is a final order of removal, one will be detained until they are removed. Certainly, there are different factors that under 241.4F that the official is supposed to consider, family ties. And, in fact, the record has these post-order custody review worksheets where there's a checklist that the officer goes through. Do they have family ties? Is there a criminal record? And then they give their ultimate conclusion as to whether the person should remain detained. And certainly, to start out with, in discussions of Mr. Soth's case, I see only have a minute and a half here left, but really quickly, just to sum up, the six-month per se rule would completely eviscerate the statutory structure that we have in place right now that the appellant slash appellees would like to see here. And certainly from a logical perspective, if you take the situation of someone who's subject to mandatory detention, they can be detained lawfully for 4 months under DeMoor versus Kim, or longer. That's an average, but we'll take the four-month average. If they get a final order of removal, they can be detained another 90 days mandatorily, 3 months, that's 7 months right there, where they have no right under the Constitution or under Supreme Court precedent to any review. So the six-month approach really must be disregarded, and the statute is what should control here.
Now, let me ask one more question, and that is, on habeas review, you suggested Mr. Sooth got all of his administrative process. Can that be reviewed by a court of appeal? In other words, if the argument is that we have a statutory structure, it's in our discretion, the bottom line discretionary decision is not reviewable, is the manner in which the petitioner was actually treated reviewable, to make sure that DHS complied with its own rules?
Sure, through the habeas statute, Your Honor, that would be reviewable because it's a challenge to detention, certainly, and whether or not it's lawful. And the government's position would be that it would be lawful under the statute and those regulations, so certainly that challenge could be made.
All right.
I see we have 10 seconds left for rebuttal, so.
No, actually, you're negative. All right. But that's
thank you.
You're in the unpublished opinion territory.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll see if we need more. Now, how much time are you anticipating on your side?
So we reserved 5 months for Mr. Duke and five months. Yeah, 5 months.
Did you used to work for the government? You're sort of adding time on. Okay, so collectively, how much?
2 minutes.
Okay, so
just a quick finish it up. Just a quick.
We're going to take a short recess and then we'll come right back. Okay?
I was worried about what I leave showing when I.
Yeah, don't come up and read because you. I can't read it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to make a first
state
point.
State your appearance.
Judy Rabinowitz, appearing for Mr. Joof and Mr. Soeth, Reverend Soeth. The first point that I want to make is that the government is essentially re-arguing issues that were already decided in Tijani. I was actually one of the counsel in Tijani, and some of these same exact issues came up, meaning what statute applied, what's the effect of a stay, does the hearing have to be before an immigration judge, and how is it resolved? I mean, it's essentially the government said this isn't under 236, it's under 1231. Tijani still said it was under 1226, or implicitly. They didn't actually decide it, but implicitly decided that. In terms of the stay, Mr. Tijani had a stay. They didn't say, well, your detention is therefore constitutionally permissible because you have a stay. They said, no, this is constitutionally problematic, and you either have to be released or we give you a hearing. And in terms of who conducts that hearing, I think it's really important to note that that the government filed a motion to clarify the Court of Appeals order and asked that the hearing could be before an administrative officer instead of an immigration judge, and the court rejected that motion. They decided not to clarify.
We have to go based upon what's in the public opinion, right. And that is cryptic at best.
Right. It is cryptic, but it still is. There's no dispute that the statute that authorized Mr. Tijani's detention was the statute that authorizes detention when a stay is in effect. And so
which one is that?
Well, we believe that the better reading is that it's 1226. 1226
aren't you stuck
A.
With the, aren't you stuck with the facts of Tijani? And otherwise it's dicta? Tijani was being held under what?
Well, I think that what the court said in Tijani was that 1226C couldn't authorize detention of that length, and so it construed 1226C as only authorizing expeditious detention if proceedings were expeditious. Because his proceedings weren't expeditious, it wasn't authorized by 1226C. What I read that as saying is it was then authorized by 1226A, which is the default statute, which applies if it's not mandatory detention. And under 1226A, the statute says may detain, and the way it has been implemented by the government, there are regulations that provide for immigration judge hearings. And so, therefore, what Tijani was saying, under 1226, again, I understand I'm reading into this. It doesn't say it, but I think that this is the most plausible reading of what the court was doing, was saying under 1226A, you get a hearing before an immigration judge. And in that way, the court could avoid the constitutional problem of saying, there's just no way to detain this person for this length of time without adequate procedures. I think the other point that and maybe this is just, you know, too obvious, but the government's position that only indefinite, that the only kind of detention that's indefinite is detention that's permanent, you know, was clearly the same thing in Tijani. Nobody suggested that Tijani's detention was permanent in the same way as in Zedvitas, but that doesn't mean that it was still not subject to constitutional constraints. And the essence of the government's argument is, unless detention is potentially permanent, it's not subject to constitutional constraints.
And what do you want us to say?
Yes. Thank you. What we'd like you to say is, first, on the most limited level, we want you to affirm the preliminary injunction in Mr. Juf's case and say that it was proper application of this court's precedent in Tijani and Nataraja. We want you to remand in Mr. Sowat's case with directions to grant the habeas petition based on, again, that it was the proper application of this Court's decisions in Tijani and Nataraja. And in terms of providing guidance for the future, we think that the appropriate way to read Tijani and Nataraja together is that when detention exceeds a presumptively reasonable period of 6 months, there needs to be a hearing. And that
no
hearing...
The difficulty is that there are times when 6 months would be excessive.
Excuse me?
That I think you want a ruling that if you detain more than 6 months, you have violated some constitutional right, at least question of...
Judge Ferris, if you want to make that ruling, that's fine with us. But we're actually asking for something more limited. We're saying just that at 6 months, that's the presumptively reasonable period for detention. So once detention surpasses that point, it's reasonable to say it's prolonged, and therefore a hearing is required before an immigration judge where the government bears the burden of showing that prolonged detention is justified. And we think, you know, we think, of course, these individuals can also go into habeas, but habeas is not an adequate remedy because, in fact, there's a case that we cited in our amicus brief, Doe v. Gallineau, which makes it clear it was in a civil commitment context, I think, that where the court said the fact that somebody could go into habeas is not enough because that involves the person actually having to do it. And here we're dealing with people who are unrepresented. Most people can't bring habeas actions. Of course, this is why if there's an immigration judge hearing and it's incumbent on the government, hopefully the court will not be seeing as many of these habeas petitions.
But, counsel, I'm intrigued by your argument because you're taking two cases that were clearly under 236 there. You were not in 241 at all. Both Tijani and Nataraja involved pre-final administrative order hearing. There's a statute.
Mr. Tijani didn't. By the time the Court of Appeals ruled in Mr. Tijani's case, he had the BIA decision and he had a stay of removal. And
but the stay stopped for the removal from starting, did it not, under 1231?
Well, he had actually been in detention for a month or two, or I can't remember how long, before the detention.
Well, in any event, speaks to that, though.
Right.
It speaks to that. And I guess my point is that, you know, we're bound by our case law, but we're bound by the facts of the cases that are decided. They're not like a giant alien condom that stretches over the entire subject matter. We have to be based on the facts. And in the facts of the two cases that you decided, we're not talking about 1241 or 241.
You know, with all due respect, Your Honor, I think that the facts, first of all, both of these cases were statutory decisions. They weren't constitutional as-applied decisions. So in Tijani, the court was construing the statute that authorized Mr. Tijani's detention at the point where he had a stay of removal. Mm-hmm. That was the statute that governed. Mm-hmm. We think that it makes most sense to say at that point it was 1226A. If it's 1231, so be it. Whatever it is, it's the same statute that's at issue here. There's no basis for saying that the statute that was construed in Tijani is different than the statute that applies to all of these petitioners who are also detained pursuant to a stay.
Right. But so, in Tijani, the court sent this back to an immigration law judge for a bail hearing, right?
And that's what we're saying is the same. That we're saying, and they did that as a matter of statutory construction,
right,
of saying that the statute requires that. So if it's the same statute here, our position would be the same thing follows. A hearing is required before an immigration judge when detention exceeds the...
What about if you're in the removal period? Say that somebody hasn't even been detained till then.
You're in the removal period, then you're under 1231.
Okay, and in that case, you don't go to an administrative law judge, right?
No.
Okay.
I mean, that would be a separate issue. It's not
okay,
the issue.
Okay, because some of your colleagues are dealing with that situation, are they not?
I don't believe so. I think that all of our clients are in the same situation.
So nobody's in the post-removal period.
All of them have stays of removal. The government is saying that because they have stays of removal, they have acted to present their removal. And so, therefore, they're saying that they should be considered as if they're under 241. Our position is similar to what I believe you know, it's to say that this is acting to prevent your removal is not consistent with what the statute looked, it was meant by that. And especially if you look, there's another statute, I think it's 1324D, which is a civil penalty statute, which says that when somebody acts to, you know, to prevent removal, they can be fined up to $500 a day for each day of that. If the government was right that acting to prevent removal, you know, is what this means, then you'd be having that anybody who requests a stay needs to get a civil penalty. But even to put that aside, what we're saying is whatever statute it was, if it's 1231 or 1226, that was the statute that governed in Tijani. And this Court...
You're conflating the statutes, aren't you?
No, I'm not conflating the statutes, Your Honor. I think that my time is up, but...
It is, but...
Go ahead, ask your question.
Basically, the structure of the statutes are you have the pre-final order, you have the statute 1226, which applies pending a decision on removability. And I want to point out the decision on removability actually is open. I mean, I think that a decision on removability, you can actually say, means a final decision after judicial review. So I think that there's an argument right there that 1226 can control detention, I mean, can authorize detention up through that. 1231, on the other hand, talks about detention during the removal period and beyond the removal period.
Right.
Here, none of our clients, there's no question that none of our clients are in the removal period now. The detention has been, their removal has been stayed, which means that the removal period is not going to begin until the stay ends.
What if the three-month period has passed at some point when there was no stay in effect?
I don't think that matters, Your Honor, because if you look at the statute, it says the removal period commences at the latest of the following.
Let's say there's an final administrative order, and at some point after that period, for a period 90 days or more, the alien has no stay in effect. Would you agree that the removal period has begun and the 90 days have run?
Yes. Right. But I would say that once there's a stay, then that person is no longer continuing to be detained during the removal period because the removal period is going to begin again. In fact, the government takes this position. The government takes the position that when a judicial review is completed, the removal period starts from day one.
I understand.
They don't take the position that, well, it's already been 90 days and now we continue with another.
I understand their position. I just want to be sure I understand yours.
Right.
Let's just say that on day one, there's a final administrative order on day one. There is no stay in effect. So 10 days passes. Do you agree that the removability period starts on day one?
Yes, the removability.
Okay, and then on day 10, a stay comes into effect. That means basically it's tolled at 10th day, right?
I actually don't think it's tolled. I think at that point the removal period is no longer in effect because it's going to start again after the stay. And so at this point, because there's a stay, the individual is still pursuing.
You're saying it goes back to the beginning again?
I think that this is the problem, and I think that that I can't remember which of you sort of pointed this out. I think it was Judge Smith. I know you know Judge Smith, but I think it was the question about there is no clear authority in this statute for detention during a stay. So what you are left to do and what the courts have been having to struggle with is, well, which one is it? Is it 1231 or is it 1226? Most of the courts have found, I mean, the Second Circuit found it in Wang. There's a number of other courts that have found that 1226 is more reasonable in terms of the language. I agree that there was the 11th Circuit that seemed to assume that it was 241, although there was no real examination of that statutory language that says the removal period begins when the stay is lifted. So you are in this situation where there's no good answer. You know, is it 1226 or is it 1231? Given that, you look at Tijani. Tijani seems to have assumed it was 1226, and I think based on this statutory language, and in fact, I don't know if I brought it with me, but there is, well, let's forget about unpublished decisions because we decide that they're not worth it. But so in any event, we think 1226 makes more sense in terms of the statutory language, also because it authorizes detention pending a decision. And when you have judicial review, you're still waiting for a decision.
Pending a decision as to removability.
Yes. And that's what – that is pending a decision as to removability, which means are you going to be ordered removed or are you going to get relief. And that's the decision that this Court is going to be deciding in judicial review. So it makes as much – I mean, you can say that, whereas pending the post-final order detention scheme – and, in fact, if you look at the regulations that the government says apply, the 241 regs, it's clear that they're looking at people who the purpose is to effectuate removal. They're talking about you cannot get released unless there are travel documents. They're not contemplating the situation. The government has done as good a job as it can as to kind of fit this into that scheme. But the factors that the 241 looks at are not what you would look at when somebody has a stay of removal. So we're saying that this fits much more under 236 under or 1226. I'm sorry about confusing those languages. 8 U.S.C. 1226. Under the regs there, immigration judges get to determine it. All we're saying is that when detention is prolonged, the burden's on the government in an immigration judge hearing.
All you're saying is give peace a chance, right?
Exactly. Right, okay. You got it. I would like to just say one more thing, though, about the limitations of this custody review process, if they're not already obvious. I mean, none of our
minutes has already run to 15.
Okay. Well, I can.
Go ahead. If it's a quick.
Okay. It'll be short. None of our clients got an in-person interview, not to mention a hearing. Just to give you a sense of how inadequate these reviews were, Mr. Juf, his custody review said that he was a flight risk because he had no family connections. He's married to a U.S. citizen who lives 15 minutes away. That was the custody review that was used to justify his detention.
Yeah, but I think in that case his marriage was late coming, wasn't it?
He had been married for quite a while at that point. Before, when he was taken into detention, 2 years before he was married.
I see.
Reverend Soth, all that it said was, you're a flight risk because you have a stay of removal. That's not what we're talking about.
I think we have the facts. Thank you.
Just a few quick points in rebuttal. The first, and this is with regard to Mr. Casas's case, I hope on Judge Smith's chart there is an asterisk next to Mr. Casas's name where it says that he had been detained for, I think, Your Honor.
Wait a minute. I think they get, why don't you let them go? And then
I apologize. I thought that you were presenting the.
No.
No.
Oh, absolutely. Didn't mean to jump in front.
We'll restart the clock. We won't say that you're on. It's not being told.
You have not been transmogrified.
Thank you. The government attempts to distinguish Tijani with this broad brush, saying that these individuals haven't challenged their removal orders. Of course, with Mr. Prieto, this is not true. He's challenged his removal orders from the get-go. And just like Mr. Tijani, he has a final administrative order that is now seeking judicial review and a stay of removal in process. One small point regarding the individualized custody review that the government promotes. In this case, not only was there no interview with Mr. Prieto, but in their custody review, the government found that he was not a danger to the community. They did not. They made a finding that he wasn't a flight risk, and yet they still decided to keep him locked up. There was no justification provided other than the fact that he was seeking judicial review.
But I thought he was given a bail hearing the second time in which he was given a $15,000. If he posted the $15,000 bond, he would be out. Right.
Afterwards, when he filed his habeas, he was granted a custody hearing.
But I mean, we have to deal with what we're dealing with right now. And right now,
and with that, even if Tijani weren't controlling, even if the burden were not on the government, when you look at this record, you have an individual where the government concedes there's no flight risk and no danger to the community, and he's been locked up for 3 years. The record compels that he be released. And we would ask this court to order his release or otherwise order that he be granted a hearing where the government has a burden of demonstrating why his justifying his continued prolonged detention.
Okay. I have two brief points. I'm kind of intrigued that Mr. Dupree wants to say something about Mr. Casas now, but I'm not quite sure.
No, don't use up your time.
Okay, I'll try to reserve 2 seconds of my time for that. One point is there's been a lot of discussion about the custody reviews that take place and that ICE conducts all these well-structured custody reviews and that, therefore, there shouldn't be any problem with substantive due process. I want to point out that argument has been solidly rejected already by the Supreme Court in Zedvitas. that Justice Kennedy at length argued that there should be no relief in Zedvitas because there was this elaborate custody review procedure that was procedural due process. The majority said that their analysis applies, quote, irrespective of the procedures used. That is, they flatly rejected that the procedural niceness of the custody review somehow satisfies the substantive due process issue. In fact, that was the third argument that the Fifth Circuit had used in rejecting Mr. Zedvitas' petition. And, of course, the Fifth Circuit was overruled by Zedvitas. So they rejected that idea that simply because you've had adequate custody reviews, you don't have a substantive due process claim. The government also referred to the fact that, well, aliens can conduct their petitions for review from abroad. That's true. But what I pointed out in my reply is that if that were the case, Mr. Casas, if he should win tomorrow and the court hears his case, he will have a pyrrhic victory because there's such a thing as the departure bar, which means that anyone who departs the country before their administrative process, review process is completed, waives their appeal. That is, Mr. Casas.
What's the cite on that?
Your Honor, I cited that in my brief. Those are, in fact, I attached the regulations in the addendum to my reply brief. The government argued, well, you can always fight your petition for review from abroad. That's true. But if you win your appeal, but then you can't go back on a remand to the IJ and then pursue an administrative appeal to the BIA, it's a total pyrrhic victory. You've won nothing. The government is engaging in a shell game by saying, yes, go ahead, go back to Colombia, Mr. Casas. You can fight your petition from there.
Okay, I think we got the point.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
A few quick points in the rebuttal. The one with which I wanted to begin was with regard to Judge Smith's chart about the time of detention. I think Mr. Casas may be the longest-serving detainee out of the group, and I think Your Honor referred to 5-6 years. I think it's important to note that for more than 3 years of that time, Mr. Casas was not cooperating with ICE because he refused to complete his travel documents that would permit us to effect his return to Colombia. So I think to the extent that he says, well, I've been kept for 6 or 7 years, I think it's very important for this court to note that for more than a 3-year chunk of that, he was simply refusing to complete his travel authorization form. He finally elected to do it in November 2005.
So you cite Pollicciu for that, right?
The
case that, I think it's Pollicciu.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Right.
The Pollicciu case.
Yeah, Pollicciu, I'm sorry.
And the Lima case, yeah. Mm-hmm, is right. The other one, where A1C undisputably applies to that conduct. The second point, and this is a theme that a number of the petitioners have sounded, is the notion that there is something inherently unfair about, quote unquote, requiring the detainees, the petitioners, to prosecute their PFR claims at the price of having to remain in detention. I think it's important to note that that argument was squarely presented and squarely rejected by the Supreme Court in the Damore case, where the court said, and I'm quoting, respondent contends that the length of detention required to appeal may deter aliens from exercising their right to do so. As we've explained before, however, the legal system is replete with situations requiring the making of difficult judgments as to which course to follow, and even in the criminal context, there is no constitutional prohibition against requiring parties to make such choices. The final point I want to make is when this court begins consideration as to whether 236 or 241 applies, as I know it will, I simply wanted to call the court's attention and make sure it does not get lost in the shuffle to INA 242B8, which is the provision that says when a court of appeals grants a stay of removal pending review, that stay does not prevent the attorney general from detaining the alien under section 241. I would submit that there is no possible way this court could resolve the 236-241 case in petitioner's favor while maintaining fidelity to 242B8. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. It's been a fascinating morning. Creeping into the afternoon, we appreciate your helping us sort our way through. Cases argued are submitted. Thank you.